You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me.
Okay, so we're going. And this is Contributions to Philosophy of the Event, section 74. I guess we should just get reading.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
74, quote, total mobilization, end quote, as a consequence of the original abandonment by being, the mere setting in motion and undermining of all previous contents of still enduring formations. The priority of procedures and contrivances in the totality of the rallying of all the masses and pressing them into service, toward what end? What does this priority of mobilization signify? The necessary forcing into existence of a new type of human being is merely a counter-result of this occurrence, never its goal. But are there still goals? How does the positing of goals arise out of the beginning, and what is a beginning?
Yeah, that's the section.
Mm-hmm.
Total mobilization as a consequence of the original abandonment by being. Yeah. I mean, I'm not really sure what this first sentence is. The mere setting in motion and undermining of all previous contents of still enduring formations. I mean, I'm not sure why it's setting in motion and undermining.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it sounds to me like that is a definition of total mobilization.
Yeah, right.
Right?
Yeah.
And this total mobilization, okay, I understand it's a consequence of the original abandonment by being, but I guess we just have to take his word for it. It's the mere setting in motion and undermining of all previous contents of still enduring formations. So that just sounds to me like the preservation of truth that we talked about last time. Thinking, representation, imagination. Seems interesting that setting in motion and undermining are kind of two features of this total mobilization. I'm not sure why, but because we can look at that later. The priority of procedures and contrivances in the totality of the rallying of all the masses and pressing them into service, toward what end? So we're pressing the masses into service through procedures and contrivances. What does this priority of mobilization signify? The necessary forcing into existence of a new type of human being is merely a counter result of this occurrence, never its goal. So a new type of human being is being forced into existence simply as a result of this occurrence, but that's not its goal. Are there still goals? How does the positing of goals arise out of the beginning, and what is a beginning? Yeah, I don't know. What do you think all that's about?
I'm not sure. I mean, it seems, it literally sounds like he's talking about drafting. I don't know. The rallying of the masses and pressing them into service. I don't know.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of the sort of what happened in 2020 when it was like, if you don't speak up on politics, you're the kind of the BLM message that silence is guilt. So sort of this, like, if you're not rallying, then you're not good, basically.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting.
Those
were
the thoughts I had. I'm not sure there's maybe, I don't know. We could keep going and see if it sheds more light.
Yeah. I mean, total mobilization calls up ideas of, again,
war, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that's part of it, probably. I mean, it's a total ideology. It's a total, it's a vision of the people as one thing, as a mass, as a thing to be moved, engaged and pushed forward through procedures and contrivances, pressing them into service. So, I mean, I think it's through ideas. It's pressing them into service of those ideas, getting the masses to follow your representational forms, I mean, he references goals, which he talked about last time. Are there still goals? I mean, it seems to me that there's a homogeneity and a standardization present here, because it's not that a new type of human being is being sought through these, through this mobilization. It's more of a symptom of it. And I think he ends with a very intriguing question: what is a beginning? How do things actually begin? And I think he's kind of accused machination in the past of sort of preventing a beginning and being just a setting in motion of all previous contents, of still enduring formations. The preservation of the truth, procedures. So it's kind of, it seems kind of like a global new world order kind of vision of there's a book by the Sloterdijk guy called Infant Mobilization. And that's a really interesting book. And I would say that his sort of take on mobilization, it's extremely varied, like all of his books are, but you know, it's about a population obsessed with ascendance, progress, change, movement, service, improvement, innovation, but also, again, I think mobilize. I mean, for instance, liberals are mobilizing right now against ICE, right? They're protesting, they're singing, they're sitting down, they're mobilizing, and they use that word, let's mobilize. Mm-hmm. And that really means let's put ourselves into the service of an idea of political change. No nuances about the issue, no discussion, just simple mass pushing, mass force, force majeure kind of, in a way, bludgeon-y war type behavior. Now we're at war, we need to mobilize. Yeah, and I mean, obviously, Heidegger's here. It's 1938. I mean, he's seeing that happen, mobilizing the population around an idea.
Yeah. And how do you read it? Sorry, may I jump in?
Yeah, I just wanted to quickly say, you know, in this the new type of human being, I mean, that was very much what the Nazis were talking about. Was the new German, the new Nazi, the new perfect person. Heidegger's like, that's not ever really the mobilization's goal. It's just kind of a side hustle of that goal. And there aren't really goals to this. I think what he's saying is that this mobilization, and obviously Germany, World War II was a big example of this comes across as if it's trying to create a new type of human being and start a new beginning and really rally people around a big change. But what Heidegger is saying is it's always actually just pushing previous contents of still enduring formations forward, practicing procedures and contrivances, and pressing the masses into service of a single idea. So he's really being, I think, critical of the type of mobilization that he was seeing mm-hmm. at his time and that is still occurring today. Go mm-hmm. ahead.
Yeah, so I'm curious, how do you read it? Because the title is Total Mobilization as a Consequence of the Original Abandonment by Being. Where do you see, what is that, the consequence of the original abandonment by being, how is that causing total mobilization?
Yeah, I mean, this word total is interesting, why it's total. I mean, I think what he's talked about in terms of what the abandonment by being is that what you have is this kind of massive sucking sound into the representational sphere, mm-hmm. into thinking and into meaning and into machination and into a whole lexicon of beings that have no being. The essence of things has become pushed aside for a infinitely possible representational reality. And as a consequence of that, you have the ability to mobilize people, total mobilization, total societal mobilization, and joining of forces and through procedures and mass movements, because I would say. Individual thinking, which I think would be would arrive via people having individual perspectives on what essences and what beings and what meanings are. They haven't just given it over to the mass definitions of machination. That state in which individuals are establishing meaning like that it would prevent total mobilization. So this abandonment by being creates a world in which total mobilization is possible. Mm,
I see.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make sense, yeah.
I mean, I would almost put it at... It might be a real sort of onto epistemological difference between right politics and left politics. And the way I see it, and obviously the people can differ, but I mean, I think that the way I see left politics is the abruption and negation of individual. Essential realities and meanings for a more of a mass mobilization, and on the right, what you have is
like communitarian.
Exactly. Yeah. And on the right, you have what you want. What the right aspires to is, in a sense, it's law, order, and freedom, so that individuals can pursue their own thing. Yeah. I would say on the right that path, that structure of creating a minimal government that is essentially mm-hmm. centered on just maintaining order enables bang and the kind of things talked about in this book, the refusal, the resonating, the appropriation. Heidegger calls it a spatiotemporal playing field of distinct individual takes mm-hmm. on reality and there's almost a sense in which the de-abandoning of being can occur in that space. But on the left, what you have is again, it's total mobilization. It's communitarianism. It's groupthink. It's submission to the system. Submission to the idea. Submission to the progress. Submission to the utopia. Submission to the liberal order. The de-individuation. The depersonalization. The anonymizing. The sameness. The living by labels, the living by identity, the collective identity, it's very collectivist, etc. And that is, in a sense, the perpetuation of the original beginning, the perpetuation of the metaphysical absolutes that sort of take over the critical thinking, the individualist thinking, the bang thinking, and allow mobilization.
Yeah, and I feel like even to ask that question, and what is a beginning, is like a liberal today would not allow you to ask that question, because they would say, we know what the beginning is, and we know
yes.
Trump is evil, and we know this is bad and this is good.
Yes.
And you can't even ask the question. So
No.
Yeah.
And in a sense, I mean, it's, you know, everybody's going to have their little take on how this flatters their own side, but I think there is a lack of goals in liberalism, that you're not supposed to have goals. Mm-hmm. I mean, Trump is kind of a giant goal-making machine. He sets goals and he chases them, right? He sets the goal. He sets the goal of closing the border. He sets the goal of destroying the deep state. He sets the goal of readjusting tariffs. He sets the goal of bringing peace. He sets the goal of lowering pharmaceutical prices. I mean, it's been a few months that he's been president. It's just goal after goal after goal. Real change. And what liberals seem, you know, deportation, fixing the immigration system. It's just goal after goal. And liberals seem to hate every single one of those goals, because goals to the liberal mean that some kind of new beginning is going to occur. And the system, the mobilized mass of liberal order, doesn't like that, doesn't like the goals, doesn't want that kind of change, doesn't want those adjustments. So they're really fighting these kind of beginnings, and Trump's creating tons of beginnings, mm-hmm. and the liberals are very opposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Should we read on?
Yeah, let's read on.
75, concerning the meditation on science. Today there are two and only two ways of meditating on quote science. The first does not grasp science as the current objectively present institution, but rather as one determinate possibility of unfolding and constructing a knowledge whose essence is itself rooted in a more original exposition of the ground of the truth of being. This exposition of the ground is carried out as a first confrontation with the beginning of Western thought, and becomes at the same time the other beginning of Western history. Such meditation on science proceeds back into something past just as decisively as risking everything. It reaches out towards something to come. It in no way moves within a discussion of something present and of its immediate achievements. Calculated with respect to the present, this meditation on science gets lost in what is not actual, which at the same time also means, for all calculation, what is not possible. Cf. The self-assertion of the German university.
Yeah, the self-assertion of that. Yeah.
The other way, the one to...
I think we should look at that paragraph real quick.
Okay. I thought I was getting it, and then it turned out I wasn't getting it.
Well, the other way. Why don't you do that? Because then we get to this list. Finish this next paragraph. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The other way, the one to be delineated in the following directive propositions, grasp science in its current actual constitution. This meditation attempts to grasp the modern essence of science according to the strivings which appertain to that essence. As meditation, however, it does not merely describe an objectively present state of affairs, but rather exposes a procedure insofar as that procedure leads to a decision regarding the truth of science. This meditation is guided by the same standards as the first, and in relation to the first, it is merely the other side of the coin.
Okay, yeah. So he's going to then give us a really big list.
Oh my gosh.
Of different aspects of science. So these two ways, two sides of the same coin, are the way that I would say he is urging us to meditate on science. One is not correct and the other incorrect. That's sort of where I thought he was going at first. But actually, these are two different ways of meditating on science. I think it's interesting, the first paragraph, he says the first way of meditating on science does not grasp science as the current objectively present institution, but rather as one determinate possibility of unfolding and constructing a knowledge whose essence is itself rooted in a more original exposition of the ground of the truth of Bang. Now that sentence to me really echoes back with what I was saying about 5 minutes ago about the creation of an individuating space in the temporal spatial playing field that lies outside total mobilization, that is the ideal goal of the politics of the right, and the way that cognition, appropriation, Dasein, meditation exists outside of the procedures, the contrivances, and the sort of forcing into existence, the goalless forcing into existence that the left tends to practice. Because like I said, I think that outside total mobilization is Bang relatedness. And it seems to me that what he's saying here is if we grasp science as he says here, as a determinate possibility of unfolding and constructing a knowledge whose essence is itself rooted in a more original exposition of the ground of the truth of Bang. Because again, we talked about abandonment by being as being how total mobilization comes along through the liberal order. And in the lack of being, but here we see that we're going to meditate on science as the unfolding and constructing a knowledge whose essence, which is another way of saying being, is rooted in a more original exposition of the ground of the truth of Bang. So it's like the Bang space, it's the Bang way. This exposition of the ground is carried out as a first confrontation. So we're going to have a confrontation with the beginning of Western thought, and we're going to look into the other beginning of Western history through a kind of a historical analysis of science. Such meditation on science proceeds back into something past, just as it reaches out into the forward. It in no man's way moves within a discussion of something present and of its immediate achievements. So it doesn't talk about science and its immediate achievements. It talks about it sort of historical epistemologically. Calculated with respect to the present, this meditation on science gets lost in what is not actual, which at the same time also means for all calculation, what is not possible. Yeah, I mean, calculated with respect to the present. So if you look at this type of meditation through a calculation with respect to the present, this type of meditation seems to kind of get lost in the unactual and the unpossible. But that's only because you're looking at it through the lens of calculation. Which is not the proper lens, I would say, as Heidegger says. So the other way is to sort of look at the present actual current constitution of science. So these are two ways of looking at science. But I thought it was interesting that it referenced back to what we were saying about total mobilization versus Bang life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. Should we read a little more?
76, propositions about, quote, science. 1, science must always be understood in the modern sense. the medieval doctrina and the Greek, what's that word?
What is that word in Greek? That word in Greek is knowledge, science, knowledge we can build upon.
So
epistemi, it's epistemi again.
Yeah. Okay. One, science must always be understood in the modern sense. The medieval doctrina and the Greek epistema are radically different from it, even if in a medieval and altered way.
In a mediated. In a medieval way, yeah.
Gosh.
Good.
Okay, start again. Science must always be understood in the modern sense. The medieval doctrina and the Greek episteme are radically different from it, even if in a mediated and altered way they co-determine what we recognize as science today, and also what we can alone pursue as science in conformity with our historical situation.
Yeah, so we need to look at science in the modern sense. Science is obviously rooted in medieval doctrina and the Greek epistemi or knowledge, but they are different from it. And while they determine how we pursue science today, they definitely determine how we pursue science in conformity with our historical situation, how we find ourselves historically rooted in that history. But we always need to look at science in the modern sense. Yeah.
So is this list just referencing the second way of looking at science, or is it?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I guess we should read on. As you said, these are propositions about science.
Okay, that you can look at in either of those ways.
Yeah.
Okay. Two, accordingly, science itself is not knowledge in the sense of a grounding and preserving of an essential truth. Science is a derived instituting of knowledge, i.e. a machinational showcasing of a domain of correct findings within an otherwise concealed region of truth about nature, history, law, etc.
There's more to read.
Thanks. A region for which science is by no means worthy of question.
Yeah, so this is an important point for Heidegger. Science is not knowledge. What does he mean it's not knowledge? Well, what he takes as knowledge is a grounding and preserving of an essential truth. That's knowledge. Science is a derived instituting of knowledge. So it's a way we institute knowledge, which I think, you know, has resonances of institutionalization, of institutions, of universities, etc. It's a machinational showcasing of a domain of correct findings within an otherwise concealed region of truth. So it's a showcasing of correct findings within the region of, in terms of nature. It's a correct finding in terms of history. It's a correct finding in terms of law. But these regions, these concealed regions of truth, are not allowed to be questioned for science. What is nature? What is law? What is history? You can't question those things because science needs those domains to remain concealed so that it can continue its machinational showcasing of correct findings. Mm-hmm. So this distinction between knowledge and science is important. Mm-hmm. And let's see where he goes with that. Yeah.
Three, what is scientifically knowable is in every case pre-given to science in a truth about some known region of beings, a truth that can never be grasped by science itself. B, beings as a region are something available for science. They are a positum, and every science, even mathematics, is in itself positive science.
Yeah, so we have this phrase, positive science. We hear that often. What Heidegger's pointing out is that what we can know scientifically is always pre-given to science in a truth about some known region of beings. A truth can never be grasped by science. So science knows what is pre-given to it. And what is pre-given to it are beings. In a truth about some known region, a truth that can never be grasped by science itself. So science has a relationship to beings. It is given beings to analyze and know, but the truth of those beings is not something that science can really grasp, whether those beings are true, because science does not analyze being as Heidegger would wish it does. Beings as a region are something available for science. They are sort of there for it. They are accepted as true. They are accepted as what they are, and they're not to be questioned. They are a positum or a thing that is posited, and therefore every science is in itself a positive science. It's a science of posited things, and to be posited in a sense means to be ascertained as true. But the truth of it is not always or rarely is actually a question to be had. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay.
Therefore, the science does not exist ever or anywhere versus, for example, art and philosophy, which in each case are in themselves what they essentially and fully are when they are historical. Science is merely a formal title, and an essential understanding of that title requires us to keep in mind the scientifically characteristic organizational compartmentalizing of science into special, i.e., separate sciences. Thus, just as every science is a positive science, it must also be a special science.
Yeah, so science becomes specialized mm-hmm. into the different humanities, the different physical sciences, etc., which therefore then has its domain, its realm, its region of posited things. The truth of that region is never discussed. It's just simply pre-given to science to know. And so science goes about establishing correct findings about that domain. Yeah.
5. Specialization is not at all a sign of the deterioration and ruin of the science, nor even an unavoidable evil resulting from progress, from unsurveyable expansion, and from the division of labor. Instead, it is a necessary intrinsic consequence of the character of the sciences as special sciences, and is an inalienable condition for their continued existence, i.e. always for their progress. Where lies the genuine reason of the compartmentalizing? In beingness as representedness.
Yeah, big statement, cool statement. So he says, you know, and people bemoan this a lot about the specialization of the sciences, right? Specialization of the fields of study. Often it's in context with doctors, right? Specialist, one doctor deals with, you know, one side of your liver, you know, and you have to go see a specialist.
For the other side.
For the other side, exactly. But what Heidegger is saying is science continues to become specialized, but this is not a deterioration of what science ought to be, which would be a more general worldwide purvey and research project. It's not evil. It's not It's not from the division of labor. It doesn't have sort of sociological reasons. Instead, it's a necessary intrinsic consequence of the character of the sciences as special sciences and is an inalienable condition for their continued existence. In other words, it's important for their progress as what they are. Mm-hmm. And what's the reason for this compartmentalizing or this specialization? Beingness as representedness. So again, he keeps going back to this idea of beingness as representedness. Mm-hmm. So in the represented, we find being. And the more we find being in the represented, the more specialized our knowledge becomes. And the less it becomes about looking at the truth of the domains or the regions in which we are studying the posited mm-hmm. pre-givens, and more about continuing to slice those domains into ever finer little categories of thought, mm-hmm. And to then pursue the being in those domains through representedness, which thereby completely shunts and avoids and misses the being of those domains and refuses to study the being of those domains. Yeah, mm-hmm, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I have thoughts on that, but let's finish reading, I think. Because I feel like we might get to the end of these, or what?
I don't think we will get to the end of these. No, it's many, many pages. Oh my God, it's many, many, many.
Just to not. Oh, it keeps.
No, it goes on and on and on and on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's.
Yeah, I mean, why don't you read?
Let's read the next two.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was going to say. Go ahead.
Awesome. Six. Every science, even a descriptive one, is explanatory. What is unknown in the region is connected by being led back in various modes and over various distances to something known and already understood. The provision of the explanatory conditions constitutes the investigation.
Yeah. So science explains things.
Mm-hmm.
What it can't explain, what is unknown, is connected by being led back in various modes and various distances to something known and already understood. So it always sort of...
Like analogies.
Yeah, it always sort of truncates and refuses the unknown by connecting it to something known and already understood. And the provision of the explanatory conditions constitutes the investigation. So you provide the explanatory conditions which lead whatever is known back to the known through various modes of explanation. So you get this provision of explanatory conditions, and then you investigate those explanatory conditions and call it science. That is liberalism. Go ahead.
Oh, wait, I wasn't reading it like that. I was thinking about my other example.
Yeah, you had some thoughts, but do you want to give them now or do you want to give them after we read seven?
I'll do it after seven, but wait, how was that liberalism? I was thinking about my other thing. Something known and under. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's in this sentence, which is a beautiful sentence. The provision of the explanatory conditions constitutes the investigation.
Right.
So by provision, what he means is provision almost like sort of provisions are, you know, things you give someone, for whatever reason to give them food, provisions, you give mm-hmm. them food and water, you give them a sleeping bag, you hand things out to them. And so, but it also has the beautiful sort of double meaning of provision and, mm-hmm. seeing forward, seeing professionally, seeing through, seeing on behalf of the professional or the pro, the provision of the, so the provisioning or the giving of the explanatory conditions. So these explanations provide conditions, and explanatory conditions, which are, dynamics, truths, domains, and giving those explanatory conditions is the investigation. So mm-hmm. there's really not an investigation.
Mm-hmm.
The investigation is just the providing of explanatory conditions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, why would I call that liberalism? Because I would say that instead of instead of supporting a genuine investigation into things, instead of looking past the total mobilization of procedures and contrivances, to find a spatiotemporal playing field in which a bang can be investigated, there is just the provisioning of explanatory conditions. So you feel it when you listen to liberals all the time. Here are my explanations. Here are the explanatory conditions. Here is how I'm using science to describe reality. And anything that's unknown in the region, I will connect back to something known through various modes and over various distance via my liberal talking points.
Yeah, I feel like there's something in anxiety there too. But let's read 7 and then talk more.
Okay.
Because it seems... 7, according to the way this, that is already understood and the claim to understandability determine in advance the region of the specific science, the nexus of explanation is formed and is delimited as sufficient for the respective case, e.g. the explanation of a painting from a physical-chemical viewpoint, the explanation of the objectivity of the painting from a physiological-psychological viewpoint, the explanation of it as a work from a historiological or artistic viewpoint.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess according to the way this that is already understood and the claim to understandability determine in advance the region of the specific science. So this understandability and that which is already understood, that establishes the region. So there needs to be an initial understandability that determines the region for the specific science, which is questionable to begin with. And then the nexus of explanation is formed, is delimited as sufficient for the respective case. So once you have the understandability, you then apply the science, and then you start explaining in a delimited way that is sufficient for the case that you've established. And then he gives these interesting examples here. A physical chemical, the explanation of a painting from a physical chemical viewpoint, the explanation of the objectivity of the painting from a physiological psychological viewpoint, the explanation of it as a work from a historiological artistic viewpoint. I think it's just saying, you know, people can look at a painting, everybody can look at the same painting, and then they have different explanations of it, depending on their viewpoint. I guess as opposed to what the painting is, what Heidegger might encourage us to look at. So the viewpoint becomes an enabler of explanations of of ever more specific angles, and
specialized.
Yeah, and kind of, I would say, removes or shields or deflects the perspicating consciousness from the beingness or the bang of the artwork itself. I mean, I think this is all very, like, you know, you could also just say, you know, the liberal progressive viewpoint of the painting, right? The lived experience viewpoint, the biographical political viewpoint. There's just different ways to look at a piece of art, all through that it's understood. And once it's understood, you start to explain it. And once you start to explain it, you start to use specific scientific fields or specific, you know, again, the social sciences, whatever. You know, when I say scientific field, I mean something very loosely, field of knowledge. And of course, all the you know, again, all the woke placards, all the political, liberal, progressive placards, all sort of talk about everything they talk about as if what they're talking about is just absolutely given. Like, there's no debating these points that they're making. They're just making them because they're scientists of the social importance of art. You know, it's like what we see in response to the NEA. The NEA NEA funding being cut, you know, again and again and again, one post after another, you know, civil society requires art. Art is important to our democracy. Mm-hmm. These kind of claims, none of which they have no evidence for those propositions. There's well, no
and those statements
there's no
are
truth.
Not actually related to what's happening. You can still have art without public funding.
Yes, you can. Yeah.
So there's just there's a fake causal relationship there.
There is. Yes, that's right. And there's a machinated total mobilization of supposed truths that lack being altogether because right. they're just statements.
Right.
There's no.
Right.
Write me something that proves that art is that civil society needs art. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, there can be no civil society without art.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a person alive that could prove that.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, totally.
So, what were you going to...
I don't know. I'm not sure it's really great. I guess I'll just say, like, real quick, the thing that it really got me thinking about with number five in terms of specialization is we've been talking a lot about, or I've been... watching these business coach videos because I'm like updating my business. And I feel like the biggest message I get from this business coach is that everyone is unique. You can all do it essentially. You just have to tell your specialized story in a way that gets other people emotionally attached to you and then they pay you to work with you. Like that's like in a way the only thing she's saying,
mm-hmm.
which is mm-hmm. not, I don't know, super helpful for me because I feel like I don't go at it in that kind of an emotional way. But I just, this mm-hmm. that's what this reminded me of is just this idea that you can just keep fracturing and fracturing and fracturing until, you know, just keep getting more and more specific or, you know, focus on this part of you to share. And then there'll be someone there who's like into it.
Mm-hmm.
So like as a sales tactic, I mm-hmm. guess it's something I've seen over and over again in the business space. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all really just about sales and how to sell yourself.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's. I would also say that's exactly the formula that like Hollywood uses.
Yeah, right.
That's exactly the formula that the music industry uses. It's exactly that.
Yeah.
Come up with your unique story as an artist, or your unique story as a film, or your unique story as a singer, or whatever.
Yeah, and just like and a then, little different,
and then lace it with as much relatable emotionality as you can.
Yeah.
Pattern it. Through a series of ever rising beats, conflicts, resolutions, and to come to a catharsis, and then everybody buys.
Yeah,
it's like Spielbergianism in a way.
So
you know, it's very much the same thing. And how that relates to this, I mean, why did this make you think of that? Oh, because
this idea of just the sort of infinite specialization.
Yeah.
And then also the beingness as representedness. So instead of in a way somehow trying to get to what the core of something is, just representing it in a different way.
Yeah.
So saying, okay, so we're going to just have you represent it like this and you represent it like this. And it's supposed to be based in one's authenticity. Like that's like the phrase. It's like, you need to get into your authentic self and like really share what's going on.
Yeah.
So like there's this like call or claim to authenticity,
mm-hmm.
but then it's actually a representativeness. And I feel
it seems like you're like doing B story free. You're like, you're talking about the difference between, you know, story is representativeness.
Yeah.
And it's taken in the liberal order as being about being, that story brings us to authentic being. Story creates empathy. Story creates reality. Story creates, emotional attachment, emotional patterns. It teaches us about life. It But of course, story is completely representativeness. It's like what we sort of discovered about the documentary world through our dear friend, the documentarian, is that documentaries are all false. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to be depictions of reality, but they're all actually just stories.
Yeah.
There's no being in documentaries whatsoever. It's mm-hmm. all represented story. So it seems like you're talking kind of about story.
Yeah.
Because it seems like what she's saying is tell a really good story about yourself. And how that, and of course, by really good story, what they mean is a super relatable, emotional narrative that people can step into and feel. And then they go through this ride with you, and then it's like having sex, and then everybody comes together, and then it's like, well, I'll buy anything you tell me to because we've fallen in love.
Yeah, yeah. It also reminds me of I was listening to an episode of.
And hold on, and let me say, sorry, one more thing, and I think it's important that when you say it's salesmanship, you're exactly right. There's very little emphasis on how the product actually works, whether the product is any good. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
It's all about getting people wrapped up in a story, so they'll buy anything you want them to.
And it's amazing. It's like, okay, I have the perfect framework for, you know, I'm going to tell you exactly how to do this, but then you get in there and you're like, that's not really telling me exactly, you know, it's not like, you know, it claims to do something because it's trying to connect to my desire for it to do that and to get me in emotionally, hook me in.
Right.
But it's all like,
well, that's the way story works. Story convinces you that the encased dynamics of the story, which are a closed world, everything makes sense within that story. And then when it actually delivers reality to you, or you have to go and then find the reality, or have to go live outside the story or live through the story, and you start getting in touch with the world that the story is about, you see that the story was just a story, and its applicability to the world is problematic.
Yeah. And it also reminds me of the episode a few ago where we were talking about lived experience and how the emotionality of lived experience gives it a weight, which is the story. So like story is lived experience.
Yeah.
And then in this case, it's supposedly like revealing imagination or a theory.
Right.
Which is actually being abandoned by being. There's actually not like, I mean, it's cute, but it's like in a story. It's like might as well be a fiction novel or something.
Right.
But but that's actually I would say my business actually lacks story and emotionality, and that's actually probably what I need to get more clients.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that this little teacher you have is probably true. That story is how you sell.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It's nice when you're actually selling something that works, but story is how you sell.
Yeah.
That's why there's a lot of story.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of, I have a few notes about talking on this episode. It reminds me of the Minot is systemic thinking. And at first I was like, what is that? Mm. But, you know, talking about mobilization and contrivance and procedure as the liberal, the liberal essence, the liberal spirit. You know, what's happened a lot in the last 10, 20 years with liberal theory and liberal thought is that it's become fixated on this word that we've heard 40 gajillion times, systemic. Mm-hmm. Everything is systemic. We have systemic everything, right? Mm-hmm. And when you say something is systemic, that gives it all of a sudden this real weight because it's apparently been systematized. Mm-hmm. And it's become unavoidable and massive and problematic, and we need to tear down the system to get rid of it. It's like, but of course, thinking itself has also become systemic. Liberal thinking is now systemic.
Yeah, of course.
Huh?
Yeah.
And so I think that we have this addiction to this term systemic, and it comes from like liberals see everything as systemic because their thinking is systemic. Mm-hmm. This reminds me kind of so I had that note. And again, I think it's, for instance, I'm not saying anything new here, but you know, the knee-jerk liberal reaction of calling something racist, so calling an action racist or a policy racist or mm-hmm. a person racist or something like that, it's really kind of the laziest way to analyze anything. Like mm-hmm. it doesn't mm-hmm. look into why racism or what racism or what is racism or why is this it doesn't really analyze the concept and when you call something racist you can stop analyzing it. Mm-hmm. There's no need to look into it anymore. There's no look into it. It's just causes, its histories, its reasons, etc. Mm-hmm. It's just you all of a sudden you just like paint it white. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to look under the paint anymore, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, totally.
So it really is a self block. Mm-hmm. It's a way to stop thinking. Mm-hmm. I don't know. There's one more. Go ahead.
So is that because they're like pulling on this huge story, emotional connection, weighted history of the word? Is that why? So it just kind of throws that at it. And then you're kind of like, oh, it's just so big, so much. There's no you're not allowed to argue.
I think there
it.
Is something in that. I mean, I think in a certain sense, it's that they think that word carries a lot of leverage.
Yeah.
A lot of impact, a lot of emotional impact.
Yeah.
So they're using it to create that emotional impact and drive things away. I also think that there is a degree of not wanting to look too deeply into things, because if you look too deeply into things, you might find that your thoughts about them are not actually correct. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you might actually start to take the blame for some of them. Mm-hmm. You might need, you know, if someone is, you know, some policy is racist, you just call it racist and you oppose it. If you were to really look into it and look into the reasons that people are supporting the policy or involved in the policy, the reason the policy has been put into place, you might find that it's there to remedy some problems that you started. Mm-hmm. And that would require self-reflection on your part. You know?
Yeah.
So it's a way to, it's a self-defense.
Yeah, right, right. I feel like, yeah, I'm curious to hear about...
For instance, I mean, what I had was, you know, it's... in terms of two large historical events, which have been talked a lot about lately, or have come up recently, which was the, you know, Trump making the reference that the Civil War could have been negotiated. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we have, you know, endless litanies of Hitler as just being a racist, evil monster. Mm-hmm. And Germany, World War II, relevant to Heidegger, you know, just being a giant racist machine that just... that's the end of the thing. That's all we think about it. It's just like it was just racist. Mm-hmm. It was just a giant, gross, racist thing. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think actually there's a lot of interesting investigation to be had as to what actually caused Hitler, mm-hmm. what actually caused the Civil War. But if you start getting into that, you're going to start kind of have to start looking critically at the liberal order. Mm-hmm. At liberal ambitions, at Western Europe, at the northern liberal states of America, and their role in precipitating war, setting up situations that precipitated the rise of a racist dictator, mm-hmm. You know, precipitated Germany's problems. Liberalism would have to start questioning its own. You know, we have that with Ukraine and Russia too, right? Mm-hmm. Russia is just a giant evil monster, mm-hmm. which is exactly, which is all liberals want to think about it, because they don't want to self-analyze and look at the fact that for umpteen years, they've been expanding NATO farther and farther, farther at Russia. Mm-hmm. They don't want to take the blame. They don't want to consider their actions as being relevant to what's happening, because liberalism is always right. It's always justified to do what it's doing. Mm-hmm. And if anybody resists it, they're just evil. And that's the extent of liberalism's thought about the situation. That's what I wanted to say.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And I mean, relevant to anxiety, I mean, when you have that kind of monolithic, reductionist, basic assessment of reality as being that whatever is against you is simply just absolute evil, right? You're setting yourself up for a life of anxiety. When you're not able to coolly and so sort of humbly and continually, retrospectively, reanalyze and reanalyze and reanalyze the positionalities and the ambitions and the decisions that have been made by you and by others and by the liberalism in you, when you're not able to kind of comfortably question all that, then you really get into this reflex activity of just branding everything that kind of gets in your way as evil. But the thing is, you know why something's in your way most of the time? Because you decided to drive right at it. You know what I mean? So it's an excusal from self-investigation. Liberalism is really good at that. And in the excusal from self-investigation, the way it continues to perpetuate that sort of vacuum of self-reflection is by positing more and more concrete and evident and one-dimensional evils. That it doesn't want to think about them. It just wants to call them evil, and it doesn't even ever really get into what evil is. It's not interested in analyzing evil. It's not interested in thinking about evil. It's not interested in thinking about the causes that might generate evil. It just wants to say evil. And when you set up these binaries like that and these dichotomies, you know, from the people who decided to destroy binaryism, then you are in a state of perpetual anxiety, because you're facing off with evil on every side. Evil is on every side. It's like you always say, like, how can half the country be evil in the eyes of liberals? Well, it's pretty easy. That's what they do. But when half the country is evil, I mean, you see it in the eyes of those you love and know best, don't you? Do you know what I'm talking about? So in your friends and your family, you see that fear, you see that dread, and that it's all because they feel surrounded by evil, that they lack the disposition to be able to analyze. The bravery. Well, they're not able to analyze it because their political mindset prevents it. They're in total mobilization mode. Again, we need to mobilize. That's what liberals say to each other. What that means is we need to turn off any critical thinking about the causative factors of what we're facing. We need to turn off a cool and interesting analysis of what we call evil and think that it might not be as evil as we think it is. All that needs to be turned off. And we need to put on our marching boots, and we need to get out our protest songs, and we need to paint our signs, and we got to get out there in the goddamn streets, and we got to mobilize. And any thinking that isn't systemic, right, will get in the way of that. And then you don't have mobilization. And then you're not solving the problems. And then you're not facing evil. So critical thinking, individualist thinking, bang thinking in the spatiotemporal playing, the free, open spatiotemporal playing field is political death. It's going to prevent mobilization. So liberals want to continually ramp up the ideas, ramp up the hypotheses, ramp up the specialist scientific explanatory provisions of their mind in order to increase and secure ever larger mobilizations mm-hmm. against the evil mm-hmm. that they are incapable of looking around.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
It's all they can see.
Yeah.
And when I say looking around, I mean, they can't look to the side of it. They can't look behind it. They can't look under it. They can't look at the past of it. They can't look at the future of it without just seeing evil.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, totally. It makes me think, or I was thinking a bit earlier also, but related, that like you were saying, if someone calls something racist, that's evil, obviously. Evil, racist, those sort of big words. And I was also thinking recently in relation to the episode I listened to that, like, I feel like a big word for liberals is depression. So like the sort of like, well, like what was that story about the United Healthcare? It was like, oh, well, this woman killed herself because she was denied care. Right. It was sort of the clickbait title. I don't know what actually it was.
Talking about that abortion thing that won the Pulitzer?
No. The healthcare, it was way back during that, the CEO of United Healthcare was killed. And then there was some mention, anyways, just like this idea.
Right. In other words, they wouldn't pay for like, they denied her, you know, some kind of therapy, regular therapy or something. Yeah. And so she killed herself.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
And I just think that also, I think there's a lot of this with like, I see a lot of it with like the health, like support for trans people, that like if they don't get a specific kind of health, then we're worried about their mental stability.
Oh, absolutely.
And I mean, so I just
that's the narrative is that if there's not support for trans youth, they'll just all commit suicide.
Yeah, exactly. And it always, so there's a level
really
I guess,
good.
Of depression.
That, by, that, by the way, that's just really good story salesmanship.
It is. Well, I think,
Gets to the deep in the emotions of everybody.
Yeah, it gets, it catches
you. So how can you condemn trans youth to suicide? I mean, it's totally inhumane.
Yeah.
So you've got to support, all forms of therapy for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
be against what Trump's doing.
And you're also talking sort of like the, what people call the victim culture here, which is that the more of a victim you can be, the more resources you can appropriate.
Yeah.
And the more your fragility, your danger, your sad situation requires everyone to mobilize around it and to make solving it their main issue, even though it's basically your problem.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's really my problem needs to be your problem. Mm-hmm. And that is quintessential liberalism. My problem must be your problem. You're obligated to make my problem your problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And if you say that's not my problem, it's your problem, you're evil.
Yeah.
There it is. Boom. We just described liberalism.
And also I think for me with anxiety, because I am a recovering liberal, I think I take on this idea that
thank you for sharing. Welcome. Go ahead.
I think actually
By the way, that means you can never not be a liberal. You know that, right? In the recovery world, you're always an alcoholic, but go ahead.
Thanks for that.
I know. I'm sorry.
So you're right. My problem is your problem, but I feel like there's also, as a recovering
your problem
liberal,
is definitely my problem, but that's a personal thing. Sorry, go ahead. I'm being snarky.
Well, your problem, is your problem is my problem. That's what I was going to say. Is that like your problem, like the problem
that
liberals
good.
Have has become my problem in assimilation.
No, you have the sexually transmitted disease of liberal problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
You do. You have the STD of liberalism.
Yeah.
The STD of care.
Mm-hmm.
The STD of, their problems becoming your problems, mm-hmm. which is really like my crabs are now your crabs.
Yeah.
Congratulations. I have gonorrhea, now you have gonorrhea.
Yeah.
Ha ha ha.
Which
I have gonorrhea, and isn't that terribly sad? So what you should do is get gonorrhea so you can know what it's like, and then you'll want to pay to cure my gonorrhea.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, in other words, liberals, fuck you in order to get your money.
Yes.
I think that's the summary of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I want to say one more thing. Again, maybe hopefully this will spur some thought. I said a couple episodes ago that MAGA is fact or data driven as opposed to liberalism. And I thought, wow, I think every single person I know,
other than you,
would look at me and laugh and ridicule or spit on me and say, yeah, you're absolutely insane.
Yeah.
So I wanted to go through and very quickly say why I think that's the case. And I will assert MAGA is fact or data driven and liberalism is not. And here are the issues that I would use to support that. Trans. The liberal assertion that biological men can become women and women can become biological women can become men and then are supposed to run around and operate in society as that without that being sort of the erasure of the original biology, right? Is the negation of a fact. So that fact is suppressed in claiming that someone with a certain biological sex becomes another one. So that's, do you see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like it's kind of like you suppress the change and it's whammo presto, now there's something else. I'm not saying that they don't deserve or should, I'm not actually taking a position on that, but it is the suppression of a fact. There is a fact suppression in the way liberals deal with trans. There's also a fact suppression in the liberal refusal to, and so what I want to say is that, you know, the MAGA position is kind of that there is a fact there that it was a that a person who was a biological man and is now claimed to be a woman is different than a person born a woman. That's just the fact that MAGA wants to at least posit as a thing. So that is a fact driven.
Yeah. Like you're like, what do you call it? Artificial inseminate. Like we're going through some IVF paperwork right now and they require you to say that. Like they're dealing with your reproductive organs.
Yes.
And they have to know what the what the fact is, or they can't treat you.
That's right. Or if I want to sell you a Chevy and you come to my house and I've taken what was a Ford and I've put a whole lot of Chevy parts on it, so it's close to a Chevy and it's got a Chevy logo on it, but I don't tell you that. I just say it's a Chevy. You could cry foul. Immigrants, the difference between illegal and legal immigrants, liberals completely erase that fact. And the immigrant debate is not allowed to operate on that very simple difference. MAGA says there's a difference between legal and illegal. So again, fact driven. Ukraine, MAGA says we as NATO or we in Western Europe were somewhat engaged in forcing this war to happen. So there's a history to this war that we need to take into account. And liberals say, liberals suppress that fact, right? The deep state, liberals suppress the fact that the deep state is anti-democratic. It is a perpetual liberal order that is not supposed to change with any administration. And that is anti-democratic. And that is a fact that liberals suppress. DEI, liberals claim that DEI is not racist. DEI is racist. Like by definition, it appropriates resources according to race. Now, whether you think that racism is just and reparative and long overdue doesn't matter. It is still racist in the way like sexist and capitalist, right? So again, suppression of a fact. The liberal, our democracy. But as soon as democracy comes along and somebody wins a democratic election, then they are against democracy. So it's the suppression of what, and then the oligarchy, right? The liberals complaining about Trump's link with money. Liberals are more linked with money than Republicans are. And there's the suppression of that fact. Right? So MAGA is fact-driven in the sense that it refuses to suppress the facts surrounding an issue. And I just named seven issues that it does that with. The biggest issues there are, really.
Yeah,
but that's why MAGA is fact driven.
But wouldn't a liberal just like argue you on all those?
They might, but I'm ready to go.
Yeah, yeah.
Again, I was trying to stick to just, in a sense,
definitionally.
Exactly, definitionally fact. Mm-hmm. Like I'm trying not to take a position on these things. I'm actually just trying to say inherent in the way that liberals talk about and face each of those issues, there is the deliberate and open suppression of a fact mm-hmm. in order to make that issue fit the liberal idea of what ought to happen.
Yeah, which is like, seems like, well, not a great winning strategy in the long run.
We shall see.
Yeah. Like, it seems like if liberals could more address the facts and provide an alternate route.
I would agree with that.
Another, like a different solution. If you don't like what Trump's doing, provide a different solution.
Exactly.
That's fact-based.
Exactly.
That allows the facts. And I think
that's right.
Yeah.
I think that's right. I mean, then that's something that people say frequently now is like, you know, liberals are just being oppositional. Mm-hmm. They really don't have any positions. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have positions, but like J.D. Vance said the other day, somebody asked J.D. Vance, who do you think the leader of the Democratic Party is? And he said, well, probably Donald Trump, because everything they do is simply just, you know, they just follow him. And then they just, if there's a leader of the Democratic Party right now, it's Donald Trump, is what he said. And which is right. But yeah, I mean, I think...
Just because everything they do is a negative reaction to him.
Yeah, they just, yeah. Whatever Trump does, they just oppose it.
Yeah.
But the point is they don't have any alternative solutions, right? Everything Trump does is bad, but he's addressing everything that they did that was terrible, and they just want the terribleness to just perpetuate, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. They don't have any solution to the immigration mess they caused. They don't have any solution to the Ukraine war. They just want war, mm-hmm. right? They don't have a solution to the trans issue. Their solution to the trans issue is, men who have become women should just be able to just go in and just be with women. Mm-hmm. But a lot of women are resisting that. Well, mm-hmm. so take that into account and figure out how to deal with that. Yeah. Don't just keep saying, they're women. Shut up. What are you talking about? They're women. Shut up. Oh, a lot of people are having a problem with that. So you've got to face that fact.
Yeah.
That's the fact I mean, is a lot of people have a problem with that. Yeah. So you can just keep screaming that these people are women, but you're not getting anywhere.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the Supreme Court said DEI is racism. You know, the Supreme Court came out and said, you can't do that. That's apportioning resources according to race. You can't do that. Well, it's not racism. Look, everybody knows it is. You know it is. You're lying.
Yeah.
You're hiding. Well, it's just what you call good racism.
Yeah. Liberalism has changed the definition of racism to say that it's okay.
Well, liberal racism is good racism.
Reparationally.
Yeah, exactly. No, liberal racism is good racism. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because it's racism that's helping things. Furthering things. And of course, the Southerners who enslaved black people thought their racism was good too, by the way. Absolutely good. Because it perpetuated the dominance of the white race that those people saw as obviously vastly superior, mm-hmm. and allowing black people who they saw as savages to have any kind of decisionary power, any kind of freedom, any kind of role in the American democracy would be to destroy America. Mm-hmm. Like they had exactly the same kind of like, we're doing good. Mm-hmm. People don't think that, people don't look at that, but that's absolutely the truth. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They thought they were doing good for the country because this system where the white people are making all the decisions and owning everybody and running everything is just what's best for the country because mm-hmm. they're the ones who do it best. Mm-hmm. That's how they thought. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what liberals think. Mm-hmm. We're the ones who do it best. We're the ones who are smart. Mm-hmm. We've gone to college. We do everything. Our racism is good racism. What are you mm-hmm. talking about?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That's it, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
All right. Good night.
Good night. Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.